This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Six more U.S. states vote next Tuesday in the marathon chase for the Democratic presidential nomination, with two remaining key states, former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, dueling to gain an edge. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren rethinks her bid for the Democratic presidential nomination.
As early Super Tuesday results were starting to come in, Senator Elizabeth Warren boldly told supporters in Detroit,
"I'm in this race because I believe I will make the best president of the United States."
But after failing to record any wins on Super Tuesday, even in her home state of Massachusetts, Warren is reassessing. An aide to the U.S. senator says Warren was speaking to staffers Wednesday, gauging whether there is a path forward to the Democratic presidential nomination. Warren is well behind former Vice President Joe Biden and fellow U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders in the delegate count in what increasingly looks like a two-man race. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Four more countries are confirming their first coronavirus cases, while Italy is shutting down all schools for 10 days. Chile, Hungary, Poland, Slovenia all reported their first cases Wednesday. In the U.S., the House has passed an $8.3 billion measure to battle the spread of the coronavirus and reduce its impact on the country. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Just 9 days after President Trump requested emergency funding to fight the coronavirus, the House passed a bill almost unanimously devoting three times more than what he asked.
The yeas are 415, the nays are two.
More than $3 billion will go toward developing vaccines, diagnostic testing, medicines for treatment, and supplies. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tried to get a guarantee that vaccine prices would be kept affordable, but gave in to opposition from the GOP, choosing a bipartisan agreement instead. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
And this is VOA News. The FBI failed to significantly improve its handling of investigative tips and leads on suspected homegrown violent extremists, even after several high-profile terror cases put the spotlight on the problem in recent years. That's according to a new report from the Justice Department. The FBI describes homegrown violent extremists, or HVEs, as self-radicalized global jihad-inspired individuals who are living in the United States and not receiving direction from a foreign terror group. Amnesty International says it has evidence that at least 23 children were killed by Iranian security forces when they were unlawfully used lethal force to crush nationwide anti-government protests in November of 2019. An investigation by the London-based human rights watchdog has uncovered that at least 22 of the children were shot dead by security forces firing live ammunition at unarmed protesters and bystanders. It said in a statement on Wednesday. According to the findings, the children killed include 22 boys aged between 12 and 17, and one girl reportedly aged between 8 and 12. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the United States will soon begin a partial withdrawal of troops from about 13,000 down to 8,600 in Afghanistan. But just days after the historic peace deal between the United States and the Taliban, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports the two sides already are offering contradictory accounts of the way forward in the war-torn nation.
Top Pentagon officials defended the U.S.-Taliban peace deal on Capitol Hill Wednesday while admitting it's had a shaky start.
And the results so far have been mixed. The Taliban, to their are honoring their peace in terms of not attacking U.S. and coalition forces, but not in terms of sustaining the reduction in violence.
That last part led to a U.S. airstrike Wednesday against Taliban fighters in Helmand Province, the first from the U.S. in 11 days, against fighters the U.S. said were actively attacking an Afghan checkpoint.
It's the commitment I made to the Afghans when I was there on Saturday. Right. We will continue to defend the Afghans, support them.
Assaults on Afghan forces have increased since Saturday's peace deal, but top U.S. military officer General Mark Milley said there's still nothing like the Taliban attacks before the deal. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan heads to Moscow on Thursday for a high-stakes meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin aimed at de-escalating tensions between armies of Turkey, a NATO member, and Russia, a nuclear superpower in Syria's war-torn Idlib province. Turkey, along with Western governments, accused the Syrian government of carrying out bombing campaigns with Russian support. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Thursday, March the 5th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A UN official has called for sustained international engagement in South Sudan.
Our actions can push South Sudan further towards sustainable peace. Our inaction can help condemn it to failure. International partners must remain engaged.
David Shearer is the UN Special Representative for South Sudan. The U.S. extends sanctions against some Zimbabwe ruling party officials. South Africa's economy contracts amid electricity woes and coronavirus fears. Nigeria's closed border boosts smuggling to Cameroon. And Uganda's former security chief seeks opposition unity as he declares his presidential intention.
The most important thing that we all do is that we all drive for change. I want to plead my own case. I'd be very willing to take any position given in a consortium of different political groups and different ideologies for the sake of causing change.
First Lieutenant General Henry Tumukunde of Uganda and Tanzanian health authorities are on high alert to stop the coronavirus. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Special Representative and head of the UN mission in South Sudan says recent positive developments in South Sudan have moved the country further along the road to sustainable peace. David Shearer addressed the UN Security Council members on Wednesday.
On the 15th of February, President Salva Kiir, against the wishes of many of his supporters, agreed to compromise to return South Sudan to its pre-2015 position of 10 states, although he added three administrative areas. With that shift, Dr. Riek Machar accepted the challenge to join a transitional government in Juba, serving as the country's first vice president, despite transitional security arrangements not yet in place. With the deadlock broken, four vice presidents were sworn in at a ceremony in Juba.
Shearer says in addition to South Sudan consolidating peace, it must also satisfy three key issues in order to be a properly functioning country.
First, ending impunity. This will require increased support to police and the justice chain from the collection of evidence right through to prosecution and court trials. Where crimes are committed, especially the number of sexually based offences, perpetrators need to be brought to justice. Second, ending corruption. And this requires financial accountability and transparency. Government mechanisms exist but are often bypassed. Third, ending dependency. It requires a determined shift by both the government and international communities to support programs that promote self-reliance where it's appropriate. And fourth, ending exclusion. It requires that all South Sudanese are part of the democratic process. It means a greater role for civil society, a political space where it's okay to speak out and to criticize. These are the foundations that underpin the constitution and election processes that are upcoming.
Ambassador Shearer says while the international community would be perfectly right to be cautious about South Sudan's recent peace trajectory, it cannot completely adopt a wait-and-see attitude.
Our actions can push South Sudan further towards sustainable peace. Our inaction can help condemn it to failure. In the past weeks, its leaders have shown leadership. It's hoped that that will continue. But it's imperative that there is no reneging of the peace agreement or of the ceasefire. International partners must remain engaged, both in solidarity and at times with pressure to encourage compromise in order to achieve and maintain the unity. South Sudan's future depends on that ability to compromise and maintain its unity.
Ambassador Shearer urged South Sudan's new transitional government to continue to deal with remaining challenges, such as these transitional security arrangements. Uganda's former security minister says he would be willing to take any position in a consortium of political groups and ideologies for the sake of bringing about change and unity. Parties to seek opposition that Lieutenant General Henry Tumukunda says he has been talking with other political groups, advising them that the most important thing they should strive for is not who should be president, but rather the commitment to bring about change in Uganda. This week, General Tumukunde notified the Uganda Elections Commission to begin consultations with voters about his intention to run for president in 2021.
You know very well that for a person like me, I think that politics is a service to the public, especially when one has a mission to set a new agenda that reflects the changing nature of our society and economy. If that is so, when you consult, you get to get into deeper depths of what our population needs, and you shape your own agenda on that very study or consultation.
General, as you know, the Honorable Robert Chakulain, or Bobby Wine, has been consulting since he announced that he was going to run in 2021. But the police and the Elections Commission, there seems to be some coordination or lack of it in terms of whether he should carry on his consultation. Now, do you think the police will allow you to do your consultation?
Well, I can tell you that the laws are very clear, and as anyone wants to offer leadership to our own country here, the processes of elections are that you must first consult the people and then later on be able to tender yourself for nomination. As to whether the laws are being respected, that's a completely different matter. I can tell you categorically that the laws are not necessarily respected.
You were the security minister of President Museveni's government. Some Ugandans
yes.
have argued that they have never been and can never be true democracy or democratic elections in Uganda because they think that President Museveni wants to be in power for life. Do you think there's a need to hold elections in Uganda?
The question maybe that I need to answer is there a possibility of proper elections? My answer is that we don't see a lot in front of us. For example, we can only campaign for 3 months. Number two, like you said, there's no possibility of connecting with the voter because consultation is ordinarily obstacled.
Sometimes some opposition leaders don't want to give way. They want to be president. When it comes to that, would you be willing, in the name of coming together?
Well, we are talking with other opposition groups. I have been advising that the most important thing may not be if any of us is offering leadership. The most important thing is that we all drive for change. I want to plead my own case. I'd be very willing to take any position given in a consortium of different political groups and different ideologies for the sake of causing change. I want to be on record for that.
General, thank you for speaking with us.
Most honored, and thank you for finding it useful to raise me and pick my views.
Lieutenant General Henry Tumukunde is Uganda's former security minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. U.S. President Donald Trump has extended by 1 year sanctions against some ZANU-PF officials, saying the new Zimbabwe government's policies continue to pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to Washington's foreign policy. Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe Service reports.
In a press statement, President Trump said Harare has failed to reform since 2017 after the ouster of the late President Robert Mugabe, adding that the Zimbabwe government has, and I quote, arguably accelerated its persecution of critics and economic mismanagement in the past year, during which security forces have conducted extrajudicial killings, rapes, and alleged abductions of numerous dissidents, close quote. However, Zimbabwean Deputy Information Minister Eneji Mutodi accused Washington of pandering to the Zimbabwean opposition and former colonial power Britain.
We have been expecting them to do what they've done. They've always been insisting on human rights, on economic and political reforms, which our president has said if such reforms are to be implemented in this country, they are supposed to be people-driven and for us as the people of Zimbabwe, not dictated by other foreign powers. So we are disputing these sanctions as illegal and unwarranted. They need to be removed without any condition.
Responding, Opposition Movement for Democratic Change Secretary for International Relations, Gladys Tlachwayo, says the Zimbabwean government has only itself to blame.
We have always insisted as the MDC that in order to get rid of these measures, we need to implement reforms. It's unfortunate that the Mnangagwa regime has been going to town and lying to the international community to say we are implementing reform, when in actual effect, they are not doing anything. If anything, there is regression in Zimbabwe. If you look at the amendments that are being proposed, we have been clear as the MDC that what we want is alignment to the constitution, implementing the constitution, rather than bringing amendments that are meant to further the interests of the ruling elite.
U.S. targeted sanctions apply to only 86 Zimbabwean individuals and 56 entities, mostly firms and legal entities, owned by the 87 individuals as of February 2020. The Zimbabwe sanctions program began on March 7, 2003, when then-President George Bush issued an executive order imposing sanctions against specifically identified individuals and entities in Zimbabwe. Former President Barack Obama also maintained the sanctions regime under his eight-year tenure. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I'm Blessing Zoo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, the 5th day of March. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Africa's most mature economy, South Africa, is in a recession following two consecutive quarters of falling GDP. That decline vaults Nigeria, long thought to be the continent's second largest economy, into first place with two quarters of growth. South Africa's woes can be largely attributed to struggles with the parastatal energy provider Eskom and to bigger global trends, according to experts. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The figures only confirmed what many South Africans, beset by high unemployment and unreliable electricity, already knew. The economy is flagging. This week, the nation's statistical agency announced that the gross domestic product had shrunk by 1.4% in the fourth quarter of 2019. That means two consecutive quarters of contraction, making this officially, for the third time in the history of democratic South Africa, a recession. Economist Laura Hodes of Investec Bank explained.
Multiple domestic challenges persist, notably the security of electricity supply, with heightened rotational load shedding impeding the optimal functioning of the economy. Additionally, persistent policy uncertainty and the slow implementation of crucial reforms continue to weigh on business and consumer confidence, inhibiting satisfactory growth.
Finance Minister Tito Boweni promised in his annual budget speech, presented last week, that better times are ahead. He identified the nation's electricity provider, Eskom, which has failed to keep up with demand and has had to implement rolling blackouts in recent weeks, as a priority.
We forecast that the South African economy will grow by 0.9% and inflation will average 4.5% in 2020. Over the next 18 months, the economy should get a number of jump starts. Persistent electricity problems will, however, hold back growth. Over the next 3 years, we expect growth to average just over 1%. Therefore, a stable supply of electricity will be our number one critical task.
7 out of 10 of the nation's biggest industries contracted in the fourth quarter, with agriculture falling the most by nearly 8%. Boweni also attributed the economic situation to the spread of the novel coronavirus, which originated in China in late 2019 and has since infected more than 91,000 people worldwide. While South African officials have yet to report a confirmed case of the virus, Hodes acknowledged that it has hurt the economy.
SA is a small open economy and therefore it is highly sensitive to global events. Although we do not know the extent of the economic damage COVID-19 will cause, as it depends on how quickly the virus is contained, it is currently weighing significantly on global markets.
Meanwhile, however, one of the few African nations that has seen at least one confirmed case of coronavirus is thriving economically. New figures from Nigeria show that the oil giant beat its fourth quarter growth forecasts, making it Africa's biggest economy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroonian authorities say smuggling from Nigeria is increasing 5 months after Abuja banned land border trade to crack down on the illegal business. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the southwestern port town of Limbe, Cameroon, where huge quantities of goods from Nigeria are sold.
At the Limbe market in southwestern Cameroon, Both local and Nigerian traders say that since Abuja closed border trade, their businesses are suffering. Traders say they regularly run short of supplies from both countries, leading to price increases of up to 15%. 35-year-old Nigerian Miracle Ademola sells dresses to Cameroon and buys rice to sell back home. But Ademola says she can't afford to pay the high shipping cost to take the goods back and forth by boat.
It has drastically affected the economy of Nigeria and the economy of Cameroon. Smuggling things as it is now is actually not beneficial, and we find it risky. We just look forward and hope for the borders to be open any moment from now so businesses can go on the way they used to.
Cameroon counts on goods from Nigeria for 70% of its basic commodities. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics says about 15,000 Cameroonians trade across the 2,000-kilometer-long border with Nigeria. Nigerians also buy agricultural produce, including cattle, rice, onions, and cotton, from Cameroon for its booming market of some 190 million people. But in October 2019, Nigeria closed its land borders to all trade to end rampant smuggling across the porous border. In Cameroon, the move seems to be having the opposite effect. Cameroonian police and customs in the southwestern town of Boya burned a huge pile of smuggled medicines from Nigeria on Sunday. Police seized the unregulated pills and tonics, which included anti-malarial and anti-inflammatories, as they were being delivered to pharmacies. Cameroonian health official Victor Mbome says authorities are seizing more of such smuggled shipments of drugs since Nigeria closed its borders.
Each time the security forces apprehend somebody who has contraband medication, the security forces seize them. About 6 months, we have destroyed contraband medication to the tune of about 50 million.
That's about $85,000 worth of smuggled medicine in a town of about 300,000 people. Cameroonian customs officials say it's not just medicine coming from Nigeria. Smuggling of most basic goods, electronic appliances, and engine parts have all increased in the past 4 months. A senior customs official for the Southwest, Pierre Ngama, says customers' revenue dropped 2% a month from October to December because of the smuggling. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Limbe, Cameroon.
Tanzania is said to be one of the African countries most at risk of importing the coronavirus because of its high trade volume with China. At Tanzania's biggest market, traders are feeling the crunch as the availability of Chinese-made goods shrinks. Meanwhile, authorities are preparing to prevent further transmission with intensified surveillance at the country's port of entry. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Dar es Salaam's Kariakoo market is the biggest in Tanzania and depends on manufactured products imported from China. But the outbreak of coronavirus, known as COVID-19, has dried up shipments from China. Halfani Awadi is a mobile phone trader. The biggest thing is in stock, says Hawadi, and that when you need a certain type of phone, you don't get it on time, and at the same time, the price rises. Those close trade ties with China makes Tanzania one of the African countries most at risk of importing COVID-19. Health authorities are on high alert. The Assistant Director of Epidemiology at the Ministry of Health, Dr. Janet Mgamba, says they have taken all precautions.
The biggest aspect of what you have done within the country is to strengthen the port of entry, because as you know now, our threat is actually a case coming from the 58 affected countries, including China. And we have strengthened the port of entry. We have employed 100 more staff in the port of entries, and we have built their capacity to be able to detect the cases.
Tanzania's health ministry says 140 thermoscanners have been set up in all ports of entry. George Ndaki is a health officer with Tanzania Airports Authority.
Kwanza tumekuwa na vifaa vya kisasa kama mnavyoviona,
Ndaki said, in addition to modern equipment, they have an ambulance to take patients to hospitals. He also said some suspected cases have been detected, which shows the machines are working properly. In Tanzania's more remote areas, such as the tourist city of Arusha, the East African Community's mobile lab project helps test suspected coronavirus infections. Dr. Muna Farah is a laboratory diagnostic coordinator.
If the outbreaks occur in remote areas where there may not be diagnostic capacity, the idea is that the mobile laboratory can move quickly and set themselves up in this remote area and then start diagnosing cases.
Meanwhile, Tanzanian doctors such as Kelvin Kaziri are urging everyone to take precautions to avoid the virus.
Sehemu kubwa kabisa inahusiana na usafi wako mwenyewe, usafi wa mikono yako baada ya kuweza kukutana.
Kaziri says the biggest part involves personal hygiene. He says making sure you wash your hands with soap, avoiding physical contact, and making sure someone with a cough covers his or her mouth. But at the busy market in Dar es Salaam, avoiding physical contact is a challenge for traders like Hawadi. Even though the virus is a threat to their health, without regular shipments of Chinese products, it's a bigger threat to their livelihoods. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. The special representative and head of the UN mission in South Sudan says recent positive developments in South Sudan have moved the country further along the road to sustainable peace. David Shearer addressed the UN Security Council members on Wednesday. He says, in addition to South Sudan consolidating peace, it must also satisfy three key issues, including corruption, in order to be a properly functioning country. Ambassador Shearer says, while the international community would be perfectly right to be cautious about South Sudan's recent peace trajectory, it cannot completely adopt a wait-and-see attitude. Uganda's former security minister says he would be willing to take any position in a consortium of political groups and ideologies for the sake of bringing about change and unity. Lieutenant General Henry Tumukunde says that he has been talking with other political groups, advising them that the most important thing that they should strive for is not who should be president, but rather the commitment to bring about change in Uganda. This week, General Tumukunde notified the Uganda Elections Commission to begin consultations with voters about his intention to run for president. Africa's most mature economy, South Africa, is in a recession following two consecutive quarters of falling GDP. That decline vaults Nigeria, long thought to be the continent's second largest economy, into first place with two quarters of growth. South Africa's woes can be largely attributed to struggles with the parastatal energy provider Eskom and to bigger global trends, according to experts. And Tanzania is said to be one of the African countries most at risk of importing the coronavirus because of its high trade volume with China. Tanzania's biggest market traders are feeling the crunch as the availability of Chinese-made goods shrinks. Meanwhile, authorities are preparing to prevent further transmission with intensified surveillance. And that's it for this Thursday, March 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the United Nations says climate change is the defining issue of our time. Its impact is already being felt in Africa, affecting food production and political stability. The effects of climate change on the continent, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
A wonderful ride with a ray of sunshine and a pinch of love awaits you. We are coming to take you on a magical journey where things are much more alive and happening. Join us on March 13th to hear the greatest Disney hits ever. So don't forget to tune in. Only beyond border crossings, the Voice of America.